Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer and host of the series. You can find Essential Dissent on YouTube, Facebook, and iTunes, and you can download the audio for free via radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. This episode is a panel from the 2019 Left Forum entitled Black Liberation Strategies in the Empire of Exceptionalism. The panel was sponsored by Black Agenda Report. We start with Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly.
I'll start out by saying hasta la victoria siempre. And unlike our mayor, I don't know if you saw this news story about our glorious mayor, Bill de Blasio, who, for reasons known only to himself, is among the cast of thousands running for the Democratic Party nomination for president. And he was in Florida for the debates, and he was, I believe it was an airport strike, a strike of airport workers, and he says, hasta la victoria siempre, which was fine. But he didn't know, apparently, that the phrase is associated with Che Guevara. And of course, being in Florida with the large conservative Cuban community, this became a problem. And he quickly retreated. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know who said it. And so sorry. And but now that I know it was so connected with Che, I'm going to say it more often because I do know the meaning. So I think we should all, it's now a hashtag, HLVS, you can look it up. But this, I tell this story, and it's so easy to poke fun at Democrats these days. And that story tells us the problem that black people have in dealing with this system. At this stage in the empire, it's a particularly difficult moment, especially now that the elections have started. And we're told that this is the only way for us to organize, the only way to be heard, the only way to make any changes is through the electoral process. Now, I'm not going to say don't use the electoral process, but Americans are told this is it, this is all you got. And especially in the wake of the Trump presidency, we are browbeaten into supporting the Democrats. And anyone who didn't vote for the Democrats is blamed, how convenient for them, for Trump being in the White House. So this campaign that started, and there was not one but two debates this week, and I couldn't watch them. It's just too hard for me. But then at the same time, I kind of regret it, so I'm relying on news reports and what my friends have said on social media. So they've begun the dog and pony show, and we see how people are propped up by the corporate media, Joe Biden, who apparently didn't do well in the debates, and apparently Kamala Harris came at him and made him look stupid, which isn't hard because he is stupid, as I wrote in my column this past week. But a funny thing happened. One of Biden's fundraisers, a man whose name I don't know, named McInerney, he's a check bundler in California, and he said yesterday, I'm not going to raise money for Biden anymore. And that means Biden is toast if the rich people say they're not going to raise money for him. Now, recently, just to show you how bad he was, they had to hide him. They've been hiding him from the press, but he did not hide himself from the people who write the checks. And he told them that he needed them very badly, and he said, he assured them, nothing will fundamentally change if I become the president, but it doesn't matter now. You know, they always need people who can look good. They have to be good for the brand, and apparently Biden is not anymore. So it's partly funny to me that he's already been shoved under the bus because of his dismal performance, but that also tells us we don't have a democracy. That if the people who write the checks, who bundle the checks, can decide who does or does not become president, then that is proof positive that we do not have a democracy. And I think that's something that has to be said so that people don't spend the next year and some months thinking that there's a democracy for them to protect or restore or bring back or save from the evil Trump. And he is evil, but we didn't have a democracy before January 2017, so we can't blame him for everything. So now we begin with the, as I said, the dog and pony show with the debates. And reading about them and listening to what other people said, it seems to me that once again, they did not raise any of the issues that are of importance to black people in particular, to the whole country. We are living under the threat of war. Donald Trump, it's so hard to read what he will and won't do, but apparently he decided not to start a war with Iran, at least as of last week, who knows, today or tomorrow. And at this very moment, when the major powers are taking sides, what are Democratic candidates saying? These people, this party that black people cling to, that we're told are our only saviors, what are they saying about war? They're either saying nothing at all, or they give this mealy-mouthed double talk. The president has to come to Congress before he starts a war. Well, then what are you going to say if he comes to Congress? Are you going to say yes? Are you going to say no? That means they would say yes if he did go to them and make a good enough case. So we have a couple of people taking an anti-war stance, but those are the people dismissed by the corporate media. And not only are we dealing with the war, that conventional warfare that we all know of, bullets and bombs, but we also have sanctions, which are not new to the United States. Sanctions have been in use, for example, against Cuba since for almost 60 years. In recent years, the Trump administration has really ramped up sanctions. And a study recently indicated that sanctions have killed 40,000 people in Venezuela alone. And let's just remember something about U.S. government sanctions. They not only mean that Americans or businesses or the government cannot do business with the targeted nation, but any other nation that does so is also targeted. And that means U.S. sanctions are international sanctions. That means that no one can do business with Venezuela or with Iran or with Zimbabwe without also suffering America's threats of force and impoverishment. Iran went through this process of the so-called Iran nuclear deal in exchange for sanctions being lifted or relaxed. Trump unilaterally pulls out. Iran waits a year, a full year, waiting for the Europeans to make good on their promise and do something to help them. Of course, they don't. And now they say they will resume uranium enrichment. But who do the media tell us is the villain? The villain is Iran. It's very interesting watching the news story of the shoot down of the drone, which was not in international airspace, it was in Iranian airspace. But this is a moment for the people who we're told are representing our interests to say something. But of course, when they do say something, it's all about being tough with Iran. It's being tough with Russia, being tough with China, being tough with somebody. But no one, or very few people, I should say, expressing an anti-war voice. And these issues do concern the entire country, but they concern black people in particular. This is a moment when we need to revive, and many of us are reviving that position that black people always had. We were always the people most skeptical of war. We were always the people who questioned what our country said about other countries. That we suffered after Obama became president, and he's still hanging around, so I guess as long as he's alive, we'll still have to fight against that. But we must separate ourselves from these people that we are told are our only savior. Have they talked about mass incarceration? Now, I understand Kamala Harris is calling herself a progressive prosecutor. She was a progressive prosecutor. I don't know how prosecutors get to be called progressive, especially her, putting black mothers in jail if their kids skipped school and fighting against a prison overcrowding measure. But she could be the next one that they prop up now that Biden flunked his test. But we can't be fooled by her either. We've seen this movie. We know the ending. So they don't talk about mass incarceration except to lie, the ones who helped the mass incarceration system, like Harris. Unemployment, raising the minimum wage, all of these things that people need and want are not being discussed. And the person most identified with raising some of these issues is Bernie Sanders. And the reason there are how many people running for president among the Democrats is to 20 some odd, to make sure that he doesn't get the nomination. So this is where we are. And it's going to be funny to see, you know, as of a week or so ago, most black politicians were backing Biden. They were excusing his racist remarks that go back decades. He had the protection of Obama, and he was chosen by Obama, I think, for that reason. He was chosen so that Obama could make clear, as if he hadn't already by the time he chose a running mate, that he wasn't going to do anything for black people. But now he doesn't have that protection anymore, and it all came out, and we saw who the black misleaders, as we call them at Black Agenda Report, we saw whose interests they serve. So it'll be interesting to see. It'll be funny to watch how they try to weasel out of supporting this man who now the rich people aren't supporting anymore. So I started off by talking about Bill de Blasio and his, you know, comedic attempts to be leftish. But I think he exemplifies all the problems we have with Democrats, all the problems we have with people who call themselves liberal and how worthless they are to us. And we have to also talk about what happens if a Democrat wins in 2020. What will happen for black people? It's pretty clear that our choice comes down to the overt racist versus the covert racist. We have a party where, and it's not just Biden who bragged about the crime bill. That was Bill Clinton's crime bill also, and the man that we were told we had to support. So we're back there again. Even when we win, we lose. And we're going to keep losing unless we jettison the whole project, unless we begin the process of leaving the Democratic Party. I think that is essential for all progressives. People may call themselves progressive or left. We must leave this party. They are the problem. They give an illusion. They live on past history of decades. It's been a very long time since they did anything for the people. We need a real people's party, a real workers' party, a real peace party, and it's not them. So at this moment, when the empire is in such crisis, it's important for those of us who are come to events called Left Forum, it's important for us to stake out new ground. It's important for us to say it is not with the Democrats. And we have to be brave. We can't let people tell us it's our fault if Trump wins or any Republican wins. My response, well, I have several responses to that. First of all, Hillary Clinton raised $1 billion. How do you raise $1 billion and you're not the one in the White House? You raise that much money, you couldn't get 80,000 more votes, roughly, that she needed in those states that flipped? Well, you can't if you're spending all your time covering up your dirt and trying to create dirt for Trump, then you can't do something simple like a get-out-the-vote effort. Then we have to talk about the fact that black people's votes are stolen. Voter suppression efforts all across the country that are increasing. And not just suppression, but outright vote theft. It has been proven in states like Michigan, which Hillary Clinton lost by just 10,000 votes. There were areas where black people's votes just were not counted. And that doesn't come up. It doesn't come up even with the Democratic Party. So I think to sum up, it's pretty clear that we have to be unafraid. It is essential, in fact, at this moment in history, that we escape from the bonds of this corruption that is hurting people all over the world. I heard this morning briefly the the G20 summit is happening in Japan, and they're already trying to weasel out of the climate change accords. The planet is in peril. Europe has experienced this horrible heat wave. This is happening all over the world. So we're talking about life and death for everyone. So the Green New Deal, which it's so funny to me, the Greens were supposed to be the villains that caused Trump to win, but the Democrats steal the program, or steal the name of the program at any rate, to try to make it look like they're the ones who are actually doing something. And there are people all over the world who are doing things. I don't know if you've seen the news story from Germany, where people literally blocked a new coal mine, to prevent it from opening. And that's the sort of thing we have to do. We have to accelerate the crisis. We only get change when the people bring crisis to the system. And watching these debates, I guess you can watch them if you want to. I guess you have a stronger stomach than I do. It's okay. But we can't get fooled by this again and think that, you know, what's her name? Elizabeth Warren is better than this one, or this one is better than that one. It's all a setup for us. And this is the moment to turn our backs on this charade. It's our moment to stake our claim, to plant our flag elsewhere, and to stop supporting this system which is taking us all down. So with that, I thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a panel from the 2019 Left Forum entitled Black Liberation Strategies in the Empire of Exceptionalism. We just heard from Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly. Next up is Black Agenda Report contributor Danny Haifong.
So I'll just begin. I have some brief remarks, and I think the real question that I'm trying to answer, and I think we all are, is, you know, what is the role for those of us who are oriented toward the struggle of the working class, like myself, in the struggle for peace, and who take our cues from the Black Liberation Movement, which, as we all know, the left in general and the Black Liberation Movement has been in retreat for some time. There are many right answers to this question and many wrong ones, but one of the most important tasks that I see right now is the development of an anti-imperialist political consciousness. Anti-imperialism is a higher level of theoretical analysis than simply opposing war, as important as that is. New polls have shown that U.S. voters in the Republican Party camp are actually more anti-interventionist than those in the Democratic Party camp, and that was polled around the question of Syria in 2013 when Obama was looking to draw his red line and bomb that country into the Stone Age. Anti-imperialism is a revolutionary political orientation that breaks through the limitations of the two-party duopoly. It serves as an ideological framework from which organizations like the Black Alliance for Peace and others have attempted to take up. To me, anti-imperialism is the only antidote for U.S.-led global austerity. Bernie Sanders' anti-austerity platform, branded as democratic socialism, has made him both the most popular politician in the U.S. and the politician that has been most attacked by the Democratic Party. His demands, however, are not anti-imperialist in scope and thus fall short of a legitimate challenge to austerity. In many ways, they don't fit the category of anti-war either. Indeed, Sanders is opposed to some wars, such as the potential U.S. invasion of Iran, the Saudi-led war but U.S.-backed invasion of Yemen, and his historic opposition to U.S. support for Contras in Central America during the 1980s. The New York Times even called Sanders, quote-unquote, foreign minister of Burlington, Vermont, when he was a politician there, the mayor, in response to this anti-war history. And the use of this anti-communist slur really shows how anti-war politics in all forms across the entire ruling class are wholly unacceptable, regardless of how selective they may be. But Sanders is running within the belly of the war party, so we really can't get an understanding of imperialism from him. And we also can't develop an understanding of imperialism from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or her affiliates, whose speeches continue to invoke American exceptionalism and nationalist pride around the U.S.'s role in World War II, for example. The leftish elements in the Democratic Party have little problem with the fact that U.S. military supremacy is the backbone of U.S. imperialism. Any Democrat who dares challenge the war machine is effectively marginalized. We see this right now, even though she's far from an anti-imperialist. Tulsi Gabbard has been blacked out from major polls and corporate media networks for just uttering the notion of anti-interventionism. When she has been discussed, it is to smear her as a Putin's puppet or a dupe of Russia, despite her long history in the U.S. military. Anti-imperialism is more than just anti-interventionism. It is a materialist analysis of the central role of finance capital in the current epoch of global capitalism. Finance capital is the dominant force of the world capitalist system at this time. There are good reasons why the International Monetary Fund has warned against the effects of corporate debt, why the U.S. possesses $1.6 trillion in student loan debt, or why the U.S. government carries trillions of dollars worth of its own national debt, as they call it. Monopolies rule, and the banks are king. Finance capital has become fat from austerity and creates whole markets for itself out of the misery of capitalism. U.S. capitalism has become dominated by finance capital precisely because the inherent contradictions of the system have turned into antagonisms. Capitalists derive profits from labor, which is a really important concept, and do so by increasing the rate of exploitation, paying workers less, and speeding up production by spending money on technology and investing in it. Competition between capitalists toward these ends have led to an unprecedented but inevitable level of capital concentration. Monopolization has driven the conditions of the vast lot of humanity into barbarity and has simultaneously increased the cost of technological investments in production and in the military, which are wholly interrelated, to maintain the super profits of the super rich. The parasites in finance capital have swooped to pad the profits of major corporations and the ailing living standards of the poor with no shortage of debt schemes. Since 2008, households, corporations, and governments worldwide have taken out $43.8 trillion of debt. The sector of finance capital comprises of over 40% of all U.S. corporate profits, up from just 10% 30 years ago. What makes democratic socialism neither anti-imperialist nor socialist is that it does not center the proletariat or the oppressed in the making of history. Black America created the value and continues to create the value and wealth of this empire, and workers all over the world remain at the center of production, of the large but largely fiat-based profits of finance capital. Without the complete and utter immiseration of the working class and oppressed, finance capital and Wall Street would wither away. Privatization, predatory lending, and endless war are all preconditions to finance capital's hegemony, which help it devour the economic landscape. Anti-imperialism is a necessary intervention because it is not just a narrow program that reforms individual aspects of the imperialist albatross. It is a spear in the heart of that albatross, the struggle for the complete transition of power from the exploiting to the exploited classes. So the question really is, what is there a successful example of anti-imperialism in the world today? I think that there is a feared example of anti-imperialism in the world today that must be discussed in all leftist circles and organizing and activist efforts, and that's China. Leftists of many political persuasions, however, especially in the United States, claim that China is no longer a socialist country. Some claim that it's an imperialist country seeking to devour Africa whole. Yet many of China's most powerful industries, such as the Huawei Corporation, which has made the news due to the U.S. jailing of their COO, it's owned by 90% by a trade union committee. China has lifted 800 million people out of poverty since 1978, and over that same period, real wages for the bottom half of the country have risen by 401%. Real GDP growth in China has averaged 10% well above the sluggish 1-3% growth experienced in the United States since the 2008 economic crisis. China is not merely an emerging world power, it is an ascendant alternative to U.S. imperialism. Again, leftists criticize China for allowing capitalist free market forces to invest within the country. During the swelling global economic crisis of the late 1970s and early 1980s, China had to decide: become the first fallen soldier in the war against socialism, or adjust and protect not only the revolution, but also the imperative of raising the standards of living for the people. The People's Republic has set its sight on curbing predatory, volatile, and warmongering hostilities of the United States by offering an economic development model to the planet's most impoverished peoples. This is what the New Silk Road, the One Belt, One Road initiative, seeks to accomplish with over $1 trillion of public spending on infrastructure projects across the global South. China's respect for international law and its development goals offer a real-time example of anti-imperialist progress, not perfection, but progress, in a historical moment where the U.S. is waging war on the entire planet to curb the rise of the People's Republic. The only path forward from austerity is anti-imperialism. This doesn't mean that the Sanders camp or the large majority of people in the United States who favor reforms such as the Green New Deal, Medicare for All, or other such policies should be negated, ignored, or condemned. What it means is that without a tireless struggle against the forces of imperialism, we lose sight of who and what is at the center of austerity. We end up falling into the politically suicidal and reactionary trap of national chauvinism, white supremacy, and American exceptionalism. The struggle to develop a black liberation strategy is dependent not only on the objective conditions of systemic failure, but also in the subjective effort of the whole left to defeat the forces of reaction that exist within its own ranks. And Margaret Kimberly did a great job talking about how the Democratic Party is the biggest problem. The future of humanity depends on the anti-imperialist struggle within the belly of the beast. A handful of individuals own more wealth than the bottom half of the world's population. Julian Assange is being tortured behind bars in the United Kingdom, while dozens of key leaders in the Black Liberation Movement and affiliated movements continue to experience what has been decades-long torture within U.S. prisons. All the while, oligarchs such as Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Kamala Harris, and the like display fake gestures of resistance to the big orange menace, Donald Trump. Austerity lays at the roots of these dire conditions. Reversing the course of political, economic, and social collapse will require a massive upheaval not yet seen in the history of the United States. While there's no crystal ball as to if or when such an upheaval will occur, we must understand that the Black Liberation Movement is our best hope for survival and that anti-imperialism is a key quality in the people's antidote to austerity. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a panel from the 2019 Left Forum entitled Black Liberation Strategies in the Empire of Exceptionalism. We just heard from Black Agenda Report contributor Danny Haifong. Next up is Black Agenda Report executive editor Glenn Ford.
Power to the people.
Power to the people.
The theme of this session is Black Liberation Strategies in the Empire of Exceptionalism. And we chose that title for several basic kinds of reasons. It reaffirms our commitment to black liberation and also our commitment to socialism. And black liberation is socialism, and socialism must mean black liberation. Black America is the most left-leaning, the most socialist-minded constituency in the country, and many studies have shown that. The reason that many folks on the left fail to recognize this fundamental political fact is that black people insist on defining the terms of their liberation, not just their liberation from capitalism, the capitalism that made them property, but a liberation that provides the material basis for black self-determination. And for that, you need to have socialism. So it is all one piece, and we recognize the black self-determination component being the forward point of the spear. It's why people get agitated and say, get up off me and give me my space so that I can determine what I'm going to do next. But the end goal is socialism. We insist on self-determination and on a socialism that serves these black self-determinationist aspirations. But there is one thing that is certain. No transformative change is remotely possible in the United States unless black America is fully mobilized and leading the charge. And we have seen when that is not the case, then the other elements in the American panorama seem to get confused. What are the black folks doing? How come they're so quiet? This is another way of saying that we need a revived and reinvigorated black social justice movement that acts in solidarity and in collaboration with other social justice and peace movements in this country and throughout the world. This kind of movement requires skill sets and a range of organizations of all kinds. But the component that had been missing from the black political scene and missing basically since the demise of the mass movement of the 60s, what's been missing is organs of political analysis. And that's why we created Black Agenda Report back in 2006. We wanted to at least get close to answers to the questions like what is to be done. A popular organ of analysis, one that regular people can read, like Black Agenda Report, is also supposed to tell you what time it is so that we can act accordingly. Well, the time right now is late stage capitalism, very late in the stages of capitalism. It's our duty to figure out what the rulers are most likely to do to us and what we should be trying to do to them to bring this capitalist era to an end as bloodlessly as possible, so that we can get closer to black liberation and socialism and a world at peace. The defining characteristic of this late-stage capitalism is that the lords of capital, the financial overseers, have imposed a global race to the bottom in which all of the world's workers must compete with each other to sell their labor at ever lower and lower prices. The Chinese did not impose this regime. American and European capitalists imposed it. U.S. workers' living standards have been falling for two generations under globalist capitalism. The decline in U.S. living standards and in especially economic security is not a side effect of globalization, as it is sometimes described in the corporate media. It is the intended effect of this global regime that's being imposed. The capitalist imperial consensus, they are agreed on this, is to destroy all impediments to the most profitable exploitation of both labor and technology everywhere in the world. That means that not only labor rights, but all democratic rights must be curtailed. You can't do one without the other. The capitalists are determined to make money the old-fashioned way by ruthlessly driving down wages and rendering the vote and other democratic rights, which we used to call bourgeois rights, irrelevant to the actual governance of society. In other words, it doesn't matter how you vote. You're not going to get your way because of the mechanisms of capitalist dictatorship. At the same time, the lords of capital are relentlessly privatizing what's left of the public sphere and commodifying and financializing every aspect of human relations, everything you do with the lights on or the lights off. In other words, the capitalists are step by step creating a dictatorship like we have never seen. And I mean that literally. This is the brand new world that they're creating. We can see this brand new world, then that it has arrived, in that even the definition of job is no longer what it used to be. I find it confusing when people talk about I have a job or I'm going to get a job, and I know that the employment that they're talking about is a relationship in which the employer has no obligations whatsoever to the worker and can let that worker go at will, and one in which there are often two classes of workers on the same premises. One, the contract worker who has no rights, and one, the more formally employed worker who will soon find themselves in the other person's category. And yet there is no nationwide social debate about this development. That is, the nature of employment is now something that is quite different. These are not exceptions. 90% of the new jobs that were created under Obama after the Great Meltdown were these contract jobs, not really jobs with no obligations. That is the world of the future, a future of absolute insecurity. And I don't mean just insecurity in terms of getting a job, but insecurity in terms of what is the nature of my relationship to these people who own this place that I go to every day, a kind of total insecurity. Now, one can understand that that is the kind of society that will require a different kind of policing. Obviously, the mode of policing a population must change as the relationship of the rulers to that population changes. And so if there is no obligation on the part of the rulers to a worker, the social contract between the people who own basically the society and those of us who just live in it has been revoked. When we're looking at these jobs, that is the revocation of the larger contract to get along at all with these bastards who have billions of dollars. If they won't even make a commitment to something as elemental as a job, it is quite nightmarish contemplating the ramifications of this new society. But we need to do that, and we need to have that kind of dialogue about a nightmare that has already arrived. And if we understood the real plans of the ruling class, which I've just outlined, never-ending austerity, deepening insecurity, inexorable erosion of what bourgeois liberties remain, and the irrelevance of the bourgeois electoral system, if we really understood that, I think that movement folks would be formulating different kinds of plans. But the most important thing to do is to break this news to the people as a whole. If folks understood what was in store for them, what the austerity dictatorship really is, I believe that even the reddest redneck would revolt from this degradation of humanity. And people can see it if we point it out to them, see the beginnings of this new society. But I think that even in left circles, these bourgeois democratic narratives and the skill with which both the corporate media and the social media have in focusing our eyeballs on what they want us to look like, short circuits are better judgment in terms of setting political priorities. So we want to talk about Biden and how he looked so bad. And we want to root, even if you're a Black Agenda Report, secretly for Bernie Sanders, even not as our hero, but as somebody who can contribute to breaking up that dangerous institution called the Democratic Party, probably more dangerous to us than the Republicans. But we're all talking about that and this new dictatorship of austerity strengthens every day. So that's what I want to leave you with today, to think about what is taking shape right in front of us, but which most of us in our political work pay not enough attention to. And that's the equivalent of not paying attention to reality and getting too lost in their, as Danny would say, they're fake news and narratives. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is a panel from the 2019 Left Forum entitled Black Liberation Strategies in the Empire of Exceptionalism. We just heard from Black Agenda Report Executive Editor Glenn Ford. The remainder of this episode consists of excerpts from the Q&A.
You seem to be confusing the simple term black self-determination with the necessity for separation. Actually, the international law and other covenants guarantee self-determination to all people. But you imbrued the word with some kind of automatic separatist imperative. In fact, in a landmark survey conducted by Dr. Michael Dawson in 1994, which at that point was the biggest and most scientific survey of black Americans ever taken, Dr. Dawson found that a majority in the 50s of black Americans did see black America as a nation within a nation. That's the term. But only a small minority would opt for separation. Separation is what people with self-determination may choose or may not choose. But nobody's, certainly Glenn is not talking about separation. What we're talking about is the socialism that we envision will be shaped largely by the black folks who are struggling against this capitalist system. That's what self-determination is about. And the relationships between people, especially people who are struggling as allies, is something that in the course of time is always worked out. That is, people decide how they're going to live together and coexist. There are no rules, and I don't know where you get off saying self-determination means separation. In terms of Bernie Sanders, the threat that Bernie Sanders represents, and Warren does too, is the threat to austerity. Austerity is the consensus regime of the rulers. They keep it in place and rigorously defend it everywhere in the world. It is their fundamental worldview. It is their scheme. They're not going to let us bust up austerity without a fight. And these super majority-backed proposals like Medicare for All, like a Green New Deal, and also a dignified wage, since these people don't even want to define what a job is, these are threats to austerity. And that's why the Democratic Party is resisting them. And that's why they have gone to such great lengths this early in the game to isolate and sabotage Bernie Sanders, because he represents the threat to austerity. And the threat to austerity is a threat to the heart of their regime.
So I'll just address the point about China. And we can't get into the mistakes of the Sino-Soviet split and all that represented. China, as I said, is imperfect. And, you know, its socialist system has had to make a lot of adjustments. And I think what we really have to take into account is how China has been militarily surrounded by the United States in imperialism, and since its revolution has always been under the threat of war. And the Cold War legacy still lives on into today. So for all of China's mistakes, and we have to understand them as mistakes, we also have to understand, as inside of the United States, our task is to ensure that we have a balanced analysis, that we understand contradictions and how socialism is never going to be pure. And we have to see that China's sacrifices are important, as flawed as they may be, and that China is really the future of the world, and that if our struggle against the U.S. military state is successful, then we don't know, we really can't see how China's impact on the world will benefit people until that occurs. So as much as the Chinese Communist Party has divisions inside of itself and has been moving leftward over the course of especially Xi Jinping's era, we also have to understand that it is always a struggle, that class struggle does not end with socialism. And China has been going through that since 1949, and I think it's, you know, going in a positive direction. And we need to do everything in the United States to ensure that the future of humanity is secure. And I think defending China is one of the best ways we can do that.
Yes, I did want to respond to your question about international solidarity. It's vital. It's one of the things that black people lost with Obama's election. One of the reasons, I touched on this a little, that black people always saw the world differently is that we saw ourselves in relation to people all over the world. And it could have been apartheid in South Africa, it could have been in Cuba, it could have been anywhere. But it's going to be an effort to regain that. There's been so much confusion since his election, and now with people, I don't even want to reference their name, misguided people talking about reparations, but from a standpoint of black people being Americans and identifying with this country and seeing themselves in opposition to people from other parts of the world. So we've got a hill to climb, but I think we can. That's why we're here. That's why we have Black Agenda Report. That's why we take every opportunity to speak, so that when black people again say our and we, when we use the first person, that we're talking about people in Venezuela who literally can't get food and medicine because of this government, that we're talking about people in Iran who are in the same situation, in Zimbabwe, whose liberation struggle was something that was so important to us. So yes, you're absolutely right. That is something that's essential.
In terms of armed self-defense, almost anything one says about armed self-defense will get your number ratcheted up a little bit higher in the list of black identity extremists. So what do you want me to say? Of course, I mean, I was in the Black Panther Party as well in New Jersey. Clearly, of course, we believe in the right to self-defense. Of course, that is a human right to self-defense. So there's nothing really strange about that. Shouldn't be anything very controversial about that, especially in the country that has more guns in the streets than any other country in the world by far. But it does change your status. It does make the powers that sleuth and slither become more intense in their activities. So I don't know what you want me to do, bruh. Yeah, we have a right to self-defense, and I encourage people to use it as appropriate. Now, isn't that the safest statement in the world? No, not in the United States. Especially in the context of this brother has me leading a separatist revolution as well. And so there's a whole new file. Anyway.
So, China again. It's a really important question, but I think what is critical to understand is that China and China has been completely and utterly mythologized by the U.S. ruling class. That the propaganda against China is probably stronger than any propaganda that is leveled against an entire people and an entire nation. And so my definition of socialism is that the commanding heights of the economy and society are controlled by a state that is dictated by workers, peasants, and the exploited classes under capitalism. And so in 1949, that's what happened. It happened in its own way in China, mostly a peasant-based revolution. The character of the Chinese state has not changed fundamentally, so in effect, China still is by definition socialist. We can look at the reforms that were made and the contradictions to that, but there have been many benefits, as I outlined in my talk, and that there have been drawbacks. There are always drawbacks to allowing capitalist penetration. I will say that we have to understand that global U.S.-led imperialism is the greatest threat to humanity, and it has always been the threat to socialism, whether we're talking about socialism for Black America, or we're talking about socialism in China, or we're talking about socialism in the Soviet Union, or the socialism in DPRK, Cuba, Venezuela. We can go down the line. Imperialism has always been the gravest threat, and imperialism has always shaped what the people of those nations have had to do to survive. And so we have to understand that it's not always nice, but it has to be practical and it has to work. So there is repression under socialism. It is a class struggle. And China has suppressed its ruling class. That's what it did. And it still does that today. And when we talk about some of the propaganda, I'm actually going to be going on a delegation with Cynthia McKinney in December to China for 2 weeks. And we're going to go to the Xinjiang province. We're going to go to the Muslim quarter. We're going to go to the regions of China that have been so vilified and demonized by the U.S. media as being sites where China is containing 1 million Muslims and all of this, what I think is garbage. They have been debunked by independent analysts like my friend Ajit Singh going there, and I'm going to also document with Cynthia and others to show that this propaganda against China is really a propaganda against us. It's really about making sure that we're isolated and that we are unable to make relations of solidarity with the people of the world, because we constantly think that we're more exceptional than them and that we know better, that we in the United States know better. But really, our base of knowledge is mostly coming from sources that are completely not only unverifiable but illegitimate based on where they're coming from. That's the mouthpieces of the ruling class.
There is no fundamental split in the ruling class. That's why they have an agreed upon unified vision of endless austerity and endless war. That there is no argument within the ruling class, no significant argument about. But there is a great difference within that class as to how you handle the wider society, or what political mechanisms are you going to use. And the whole of that class was thrown into disarray by this rogue element from among in their midst, although a minor player in their midst. He just was a media celebrity, not a real player, relatively speaking, in the class. But Trump, with his red meat appeal to the denizens of the white man's party, if you're going to have a white man's party, I guess Trump said, feed them the red meat, stop these dog whistles and teasing them. And that's what he did. And it worked marvelously and just upset the whole game of the polite business class that controlled the Republican Party and up to that time. And it's interesting. They responded by letting loose all of their hyenas on Trump, who represented a big problem for them. That's not a split in the ruling class, a problem in their mechanism for rule. One of them is a Republican Party, the others are a Democratic Party. So that created that kind of problem. They responded by assembling a whole menagerie of people to beat Trump. I think he had 16 opponents. But with his red meat stuff for the folks in that party, he beat them all. Also, he was probably even more important. He got $5 billion in free airtime from the corporate media, most of which is Democrat associated. And we know why that happened, because the WikiLeaks showed us that the DNC was urging its friendly reporters and everybody else to encourage the Trump campaign, because they thought that he was the one that they could easily beat. So Trump's success was largely a function of some other ruling class folk who thought that he would be a straw man to knock down. But that's not a split in the ruling class. There's a lot of drama that goes on that does not qualify as a split in the ruling class. But they were also very, very upset that Trump, with his statements against regime change and other statements that seemed to say that he would bring an end to the Obama offensive from 2011 all the way to the present. It was a massive imperial offensive under President Obama, getting the U.S. back on that imperial track that they had fallen off of with the debacle and defeat of the United States in Iraq under Bush. Obama was supposed to correct all of that and bring a new face, make folks like the United States, but get back on that track of empire. And that's what he did. And Trump, with his anti-everything Obama, including Obama's imperial charge, was upsetting to them. So they then invested almost all their marbles. I'm talking about the national security state. We saw an unprecedented number of former and present CIA and FBI and NSA people crowding into Hillary Clinton's big fat tent, overpacked tent. We saw in 2016, after Trump took over the mechanism of the Republican Party, that the ruling class then all crowded into the Democratic Party. It was the only functioning one of the duopoly mechanisms for them to work through. And so no wonder the Democratic Party is now attacking Trump from the right. The Democratic Party is the McCarthyite Party, raging a real anti-red campaign when there is no red superpower anymore, but for their own reasons. That party did change in terms of the preponderance of the national security state folks' influence, personified by the Mueller report. I mean, all of it's right, it can be boiled down to that document. So there are problems in the ruling class in terms of how they rule, but that's not a split in the ruling class in terms of how they want to organize society. It is austerity and it is endless war, and they ain't going to change because that's the only vision they got. And if folks in general understood that and saw the bleak future that is in store for them, we would have revolution in the air again.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer and host of the series. This episode was a panel from the 2019 Left Forum entitled Black Liberation Strategies in the Empire of Exceptionalism. The panel was sponsored by Black Agenda Report, and we first heard from Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly. Next, we heard from Black Agenda Report contributor Danny Haifong. Lastly, we heard from Black Agenda Report executive editor Glenn Ford. Black Agenda Report can be found at blackagendareport.com, and they produce an interesting and timely podcast called Black Agenda Radio. You can find Essential Dissent on YouTube, Facebook, and iTunes, and you can download the audio for free via radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. Thanks for listening.